I took the call professionally. I hung up, and then I just cried for like half a day in my like tiny studio in Hayes Valley. And it got me asking the very important questions, which is like, what am I doing here?
Welcome to Path to Growth. I'm Tracy Young, co-founder and CEO of Tiger Eye. Today, we are joined by another Tracy, Tracy Lawrence, previous co-founder and CEO of Choose, and now executive coach, to discuss all things growth. Tracy, welcome.
Thank you. This is so fun to be on this with you.
So tell me about growing up. Where were you raised? Tell me about mom and dad, what you learned from them.
Yeah, so I was born and raised in LA, and I'm mixed. So my mom is Chinese and my father is Jewish, which is actually how we came up with the name for the company, for Choose, because I was always like mixed heritage, I think, has always been an important part of my life. But my parents, they ran their own company. And I told them I would never be an entrepreneur because I hated how much they talked about work. Like, they talked about work at the dinner table. They talked about work in the car rides, like to school and from school. And so I told them I would never do it. So that's what I thought I would learn from my parents. But I think, funny enough, I have so much of my parents' energy that it couldn't help but like start businesses. And then after I started my venture company and sold it, now I have a coaching practice. Like, I can't help but start things. So I think that was probably one of the biggest things I learned from my parents.
It's so funny. My parents ran a business together too, and they were always arguing all through my childhood about that business. And I remember looking at them and it's like, man, I am never going to argue with my spouse about money. I'm never going to argue with my spouse about work. And then I totally started a company with my partner, and this is our second company together. I think the difference is I'm in charge of the money, right? So he's in charge of technical. So there's like a clear delineation of responsibilities. It makes for less arguments.
It's tempting. Like, I think about it with my partner all the time. And then I'm like, no, like, you saw what happened with your parents. And I think it's totally possible if you have good communication to do it with a partner. I just saw where it went like haywire between them for so long.
So before we get into Love Engine, tell us more about Choose. Why did you start the company? And maybe, you know, like your biggest lesson learned from the company and why you've decided to now be a coach for other CEOs and founders and executives.
I started it in college. And I love downtown LA, right? So I'm born and raised there. My parents' company was there. They worked in the garment, you know, they were in the fashion business. My mom was a designer. My dad did sales. So like I would be with them in the office all the time as a kid during the summer. And I would just wander the streets of downtown LA. And I loved it. And so when I went to USC, which is based in downtown, I met a bunch of students that hated downtown LA. And it kind of broke my heart. So I was like, no, this is my hometown. And I thought, okay, how do I trick people into loving downtown? I'll get them to eat downtown because we have the most amazing local eateries.
It's true.
And that was kind of like the bridge to try to get people to fall in love with my city. And from there, as I started working with restaurants, they all started to ask me about catering. And they were asking me about student organizations on campus that needed catering. Meanwhile, the student organizations were telling me that they were sick of Subway, but, you know, they didn't know all the restaurants downtown. And so that kind of was the beginnings of me starting this marketplace where I would reach out to the restaurants and I would build menus for the student organizations. And then I just took a cut in the middle. And so it was actually like a deep love of my city that I think started the business. Of course, I saw the market opportunity and then I met my co-founder and I saw it as a venture-backed opportunity. But at its core, it was like very much built on that love, you know, and then like 10 years later, it became a venture-backed business where we were in multiple cities, you know, and it wasn't just about LA. I have so many lessons, but one of the biggest ones for me was that I didn't realize how closely the personal and the professional lived. Like, I thought when I went to work, I could leave the personal at the door. And I was like, cool. I am like, I have a work role. I have work face, you know, like this is who I am. But I started to see as I scaled the company that a lot of shadow followed me. A lot of my history followed me. And that history, if I didn't deal with it, if I didn't do therapy, if I didn't do inner work, the history would follow me around and I would start to hire people with very similar shadow to me or that would trigger my shadow. So for instance, when I was 10 years old, I was really badly bullied. And it's kind of led me to one of my default kind of modes can be like, oh, I'm apart. You know, I don't feel I belong. And a big part of choose was the feeling of we want people to belong over food. Well, I remember someone in my team tapped me on the shoulder when we were working in this big warehouse space in San Francisco. And they tapped me on the shoulder and they're like, can you come into the kitchen? And everybody's there looking at me. And I freaked out. Like this little girl in me that had been bullied at 10 years old pops out of me and is like, oh my God, they're going to fire me. I don't know why, like not that they even could, but I was like, they're going to fire me or they're going to mutiny or something. And I walk over kind of in trauma mode to the table and everybody parts ways and they have a cake on the table. And the cake is it's an anniversary cake for me and my co-founder starting the business.
Aww,
got like our faces on it.
Yeah.
And it was so sweet. And I was like, wow, that is wild that my primary storyline in my head was a negative storyline of me not belonging or me not being included. And I could throw you thousands of examples like that. But for me, and this is why I started executive coaching, I realized that doing my inner work was going to be the main way for me to scale my outer work. Like, yes, there are skill sets. I had mentors and I had advisors and I had a board, like frameworks and all of that were great. But there were certain pieces of inner work that if I could not move past it, my ego would be greater than my vision. And I always had to keep those two things under check. I always wanted my vision to be greater than my ego. I had to eat a lot of humble pie. I had to be able to swallow my ego, take feedback, especially when it hurt and it was triggering. And so now as a coach, like, my favorite part of coaching is to help people do the inner work, to move aside the parts of them that come in and say, this is what reality is, when it's really their trauma and they're not seeing reality for what it is. And I try to help them move towards presence so that we can make better decisions, you know, as a coaching CEO team.
This brings a lot of thoughts to mind. I really do think that the key lever we have as leaders is to work on ourselves. Being physically stronger and having more energy does help as being a founder and a leader because you can take on more. You can take on more pressure without breaking. And the biggest lever we have as leaders is to like do personal work on ourselves. And I'm so grateful for not only getting to work with really talented and just experienced people over the years and getting to learn from them, but just the pressure that startups put you in, that you have really no choice. If you want to survive, you just have to grow as a person. And that starts inside your heart, inside your head. And of course, the work itself is really hard and it takes practice. And it's work I'm still doing after running startups for, you know, 13 years. But I totally agree with the way you think. Okay, switching gears. In an article in Forbes, you shared about a really tough moment with the VC where you invested a lot of time with them only to hear, hey, this is a tough market that requires a ton of hand-to-hand combat and we don't have conviction in the team because we don't think you're out for blood. Yeah. It's such an absurd thing to say. I mean, is that, I've never thought about my 13 years of being a startup founder and running a business as being out for blood. Like, of course I want to be competitive, but I've never thought of it as like, you know, in such violent, aggressive terms.
So violent.
So yeah, tell me more about this moment and like, what were you thinking when you got told this?
Well, you want to talk shadow work, right? Like it was so confrontational. Now, I will give it to this VC that I think he was saying something that maybe other people would not say, right? Maybe there were people that felt that along the way. They were like, she's too nice. You know, like she's too kind, whatever the story was about me. And so they go, well, you know, we don't invest in that market. So I will give him that he was really candid with me. That candor lit up a huge, it was the beginning of an explosion within me. So like I took it, you know, whatever. I took the call professionally. I hung up and then I just cried for like half a day in my like tiny studio in Hayes Valley. And it got me asking the very important questions, which is like, what am I doing here? Am I out for blood? Do I belong? Right? All of the trauma came up. And I kind of got, at first I was like, I am out for blood. I'm super combative, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, let's be honest. Am I really out for blood? I was like, no, actually. He's actually right. I'm not. Because I very much have, this business was born out of love for my city, right? Like, this business was born also out of my love for food. I'm Chinese and Jewish. Like, all we do is eat and then talk about our next meal while we're eating. This was always going to be a culture and a service that was born out of the love of bringing people together. And I think once that clicked on for me, it kind of lit a fire within me that I shared with the culture, which is like, why don't we actually, instead of hiding in the shadows and me being like, I'm super competitive, I'm masculine, I'm all these things that a big part of me isn't, why don't we just embrace who we are? And let's call ourselves a love company. And that's actually exactly what we did as a reaction to this comment and being rejected. And it ended up being our platform, our culture. It helped us raise our $40 million. It eventually helped us get to Foundry Group, which was like total heart and soul alignment. But it all came out of that very tough moment where like the other fork in the road was I quit. I'm like, you know what? I'm not built for tech. This is not what tech is, which is wrong because I don't think tech is any one thing.
I really like the judo flip. You're like, you're right. I'm not out for blood. I'm actually out for love. And, you know, in your face, I'm just going to lean into this. And love may feel out of place in business for, you know, that investor and a lot of people. But you said that word several times here in context to business. So why is it so important?
I spent a lot of time thinking about what love means in the context of business, outside the context of business, too. And it's morphed over time. But the philosophy that I come to is that loving somebody in a professional context is truly caring about them. It's truly caring about them in a way where they don't feel like they're just a cog in the machine. And so what we ended up realizing was that love had to sit alongside excellence. And these two work together. So somebody wouldn't work hard unless they felt that they were a human and validated in front of you. But you weren't holding anybody to the highest standard unless you did it. Like, you weren't actually loving them unless you held them to a standard of excellence. And so sometimes firing someone was a loving action. It didn't always feel like an act of love. But if they were miserable, they couldn't perform, and the company was scaling beyond them, and they were miserable, eventually you did have to hold them to the high standard and realize this isn't the fit for you. And so in that way, I felt the love culture kind of work within excellence. But I also felt that the mission of the company had been so built around love and that care that it attracted a certain kind of person. And it also polarized a certain kind of person. I had people that when I told them about the love culture, how we would talk about our emotions, we would hug each other at work, they were like, I wouldn't touch that with a 10-foot pole. And I was like, fantastic, good to know. And then I had other people apply and be like, I will be any role at the company. I'll do sales. I'll be a janitor. I love this company. So it was, and at first the polarity was uncomfortable, especially as a people pleaser. I want everyone to love my company. But eventually it was like, oh no, this is great because the people that were on board were really on board. And then there were other people that were like, never in my life. And I was like, good, we should know that in the beginning and not waste time.
It's a wonderful filter, isn't it? Just the people who are never going to work just self-selected out.
Yes.
You wrote in very beautifully, I thought, and candidly about how selling your company made you feel like a failure. Tell our listeners more about this, because on the outside, it's very shiny. On the outside, you know, I think we all think that it was a success story, right? But here's the founder, CEO feeling like a failure. So tell us more about that.
Oh, man. I mean, it is something that 4 years out, I continue to grapple with. I mean, I think I wrote that just a month or two ago. And the feeling is very much defined by the belief that if you don't return back the venture capital, then you have failed. So it's a very, very narrow lens of success or failure based on venture returns. And that was kind of... Of course, you're set up to fail. And especially when I looked at the stats, and I think the stats were like, it was over, let me see, 65% of investment rounds fail to return even 1x capital. I was like, oh, wait, we are all setting ourselves up to fail as founders if this is the one metric that we live and die by. So, but I can say that logically, right? And then I think the logical is sort of helping with it, but emotionally, there's still the sense of, wow, I poured 10 years of my life into this. And I sold the company, and I sold it under really rough circumstances because we were going into the sale process. Well, we were actually towards the end of the sale process as the pandemic was hitting. And we were B2B. We sold to offices. All of our offices started shuttering. So the deal on the table basically died. We resuscitated it for a fraction of the value, but it just broke my heart. I mean, I'd put in 10 years of work plus the months of work to get this across the finish line, only to have it fall apart, and then we resuscitate it for a fraction. It was just, so there's trauma in that. And then when we sold, we and a lot of our team was going to get hired by the new company. Well, with the pandemic coming, we had to do a turnaround, a layoff in like 48 hours. And I couldn't even hug my team goodbye because it was the layoff. And I know that some of my team looked at me and was like, did you make money from this? Had you been planning this all along? Because we had told them, hey, like, we're going to have this great acquisition. Like, well, some of you are going to be moving over. So there were all these rumors and stories. And there was a lot I couldn't say at the time.
Yeah.
And it was devastating.
Yeah.
And so moving through that, and then eventually moving to Hawaii and becoming a coach, it's kind of been reconciling, like, was that all for naught? And now, you know, something has been reborn out of it, which is beautiful, but I still have that part of me that's like, no, that feels like failure. And that's something that I work through every day.
Yeah, just the worst timing. And 4 years later, it's still hard for me to believe, because it happened to all of us, that we went through a worldwide pandemic and a worldwide shelter in place, and all businesses stopped briefly wondering what was going to happen. Anyways, switching gears, tell us about Love Engine.
So Love Engine is kind of my pursuit in a single person solo venture now to be the coach that I really wanted. You know, I think that, you know, I was a founder, so there's a lot that I get. There's a lot of empathy that I get for the process. You know, I have playbooks. I have things to make to provide leverage as a founder is scaling. But at the heart of it, I really wanted someone that could understand how much the personal was professional and to help me do my inner work in order to scale. But not in just the way a therapist would do it, because therapists often don't understand the founder's journey. They try to, and I think they're wonderful in many respects. But in particular for a scaling founder, there's a sense of just wanting to be witnessed on the journey. And I know as a CEO for me and for so many founders, it's hard to share unprocessed truths with people just to get it out, to be witnessed and to think through it. Because everybody wants something from you. Everybody has some sort of agenda or an expectation of you to be like strong and to have all the answers. And so if you don't have the space to be able to process your own thoughts raw and unfiltered, what happened for me as a CEO is that I would lose integrity with myself. I wouldn't be honest with myself. Then how could I be honest with anyone else? Which is why over the course of Choose, I had three coaches. I felt it was always important to have a coach. And so now I like to work with CEOs and founders to be that space. And then also to hold them to their highest self. And to be like, I know when you're at your best that you give the benefit of the doubt, you know, to that executive or your co-founder. Like, there is something about me holding their greatest self that even when they're stressed, which is most of the time, I can remind them of who they are and then help them with techniques for how to resource and be that best version of themselves. And ultimately, you know, where I've come to with it is, if I can help leaders heal themselves, then that leadership heals everybody else that works for them, their clients, hell, even their investors, definitely their team. So I want to heal leadership so it can become healing leadership, how I think about it.
Because they have just an incredible opportunity for influence and impact.
Whether they like it or not, whether they realize how much their inner world is affecting everybody else's inner world.
As an executive coach who talks to a lot of founders, what are the biggest concerns you're hearing from founders these days? I mean, our world is ever-changing. There's a lot going on right now. Is there any themes that you could share with us?
The biggest ones still are the stress and the burnout. Now, people don't call it burnout typically, although I do have sometimes people come to my practice and they are at their wits' end. But it typically comes in the shape of, I don't have enough time. Everybody's pulling on me for time. And I actually think the biggest trend line here is a lack of boundaries. Very spongy boundaries among founders. Because we feel beholden to so many other people and we don't want to let people down. Sometimes it's because of them. Sometimes it's because of us. It's our image. And I'm a people pleaser. So like I am like number one offender for this. But I saw it in myself where I wouldn't say no enough or I wouldn't protect my space around strategic and solo time, right? Which for, especially for the CEO, is one of the most critical spaces we can hold for ourselves. How do we step back, look at the business, take a bird's eye view and be creative? And founders go, I don't have time for that. I have too many one-on-ones. I have too many meetings. And it's like, well, you say that you have to do this, but you're actually choosing to do this. So let's be clear about the choices that you're making. So I think it's kind of a, how do you train people to hold tight but not feel like they're selfish? I think there's a big people-pleasing streak generally in culture these days. And I think actually, you know, you can talk about boundaries all day, but implementing it with your team is, it's challenging.
It's really true. I think a big part of time management is admitting to what do we have to do because it's part of the job and maybe we don't like it as much, but what is the stuff that we actually like doing? Like for me, it was always jumping in customer support conversations. And by this point we had like, I don't know, 15 person customer support team, right? They didn't need the CEO founder to jump on conversations with customers, like troubleshooting them. But I secretly loved doing that. I loved seeing like where the product sucked, why people were confused. And, but you know, in the meantime, there's actually real decisions that only the CEO can make, right? And only the CEO should be making the space to think about longer term for the company. Those are the things that I actually needed to do, but I made up every excuse under the sun to not do it because it was hard and it hurt. I knew it was painful. I knew that we probably needed a big strategic shift, and it was just easier to go do the thing that I wanted to do instead of the thing I actually had to do.
Yo, there is something too about as a founder kind of following your bliss more, because there's intuition in that. And the more that I see founders separate from their customers, the more I see them on the path to burnout. Because, you know, we build technology companies behind screens and interfaces. Right? We don't get to hang out like in a restaurant. You are with your customer all day, every day. But as a founder, we could be away from our and in a remote world. Like we might not get to shake our customer's hand for years. And that really burns people out, let alone makes them less strategic at their work. And I don't think we often go into building a startup with the idea of, oh, I'm going to do a lot of the job that I want to do. Like towards the last 3 or 4 years of the company, I realized how much I loved doing branding, kind of being the public face of the company and working on culture. And I tried to make that 60% of my job. But when it dropped to like less than 60% to really like 30%, I was far faster on that path to burnout because I was like, I don't love what I do. I'm human. We have preferences. And I think it's okay to express that. But the founder has to feel like I have to do whatever job the company needs of me. True. And you have to acknowledge that that only takes you so far in your energy and your capacity.
How do you think about building team culture? I really loved hearing you say that, you know, that is where you needed to spend most of your time to like motivate the team and inspire them. So what behaviors did you encourage and what did you want to minimize?
I think the first thing is to jump back to what we were talking about. I think it's important to be polarizing in your culture. Too many cultures are a little bit diffuse. They like, you know, especially in the first place you can see it is when you have 10 values. Hell, even if you have 5 values. We got to a point where we would have 3, maximum 5, but people can't remember 10. They can barely remember 5. And I think you stand for a lot less when you say you have 10, because all of a sudden nothing's that important. So I would double down on 1 or 2 really important things to you. And then go extreme on that. Because everybody says transparency, hustle culture, You know, be resourceful, but that means nothing unless it is the one thing that you really care about. If you care about transparency, have transparent salary, right? Be transparent in your runway. Like, go all in on it and let people know that that's what you really care about. For us, with kind of the behaviors that we really cared about, it was, again, it was always under the pillars of love and excellence. And so one of the unique behaviors that we touted was being able to share. We would do color check-ins. So instead of asking, how are you? We'd ask, what color are you? And people would say red, yellow, or green. And it could be personal or it could be professional. And sometimes, you know, and I always led and I was always the most vulnerable, because you as the leader, if you're not vulnerable, nobody else is going to go to that level. And it would help us really calibrate, where is the whole human today? Because maybe professionally you're green and you're rocking it, but maybe your dog is at the vet and super sick right now. So maybe you're actually kind of red, and that's the whole human. We're not like mechanisms where we can leave our personal lives at the door. So we would encourage people to have some level of emotional awareness and EQ to be able to share that without going into therapist mode. And we would train people on how to do that. That's like one behavior that we really touted. There was a bunch that we would do trainings on.
It's so true that one of the reasons startups and growing a company is hard is because, you know, you've got these really impossible goals and then life doesn't stop. You know, your parents get sick, your kids get sick, someone's in the hospital, someone died, your pet died, you know, whatever it is. And it's like all this emotion that comes into work. At Tiger Eye, our first core value, I'm sharing this and I think you'll like it, our first core value is wholeheartedness. My co-founder mentioned, he's like, I'm not even sure if that's a word, but it is our core value. And wholeheartedness means, look, it's going to be hard. Life is hard, even if you're lucky, for all of us, right? And so work is also going to be hard. And so we expect everyone to bring their whole heart into whatever it is they're doing. If there's something at home or in their personal life they need to go take care of because it's hard right now, just log off work. Go take care of that. And then, but once you're at work, we expect you to be 100% here, right? To be 100% present with your teammates and to solve problems together and to build together. And then there's a time in the day where you're going to log off, and we want everyone to be completely wholehearted in whatever they're doing after work and not checking Slack and not trying to email their teammates, because there's a time for that in the morning, right? And it just helps us out with the feeling of overwhelm, because I really believe that it's when we like try to split our attentions in like so many directions at the same time, that's when it feels extra hard.
Right. And what I love about that value is it is a value that is grounded in reality. You know, when we think about toxic positivity, right? And it's like, oh, have work be joyful all the time. You know, I think we could probably do better as a culture to bring more joy to work, but that's not, life doesn't work that way. We're not always one or the other. And I think the wholeheartedness is basically saying, look, sometimes it's going to suck. And let's embrace that too as part of the human experience, which also appeals to me very much in kind of a Buddhist sense of like, let's turn towards reality. Like, what is reality showing us? And like, if you're having a bad day at work, that is what is real. You don't have to resist it more. You know, they call it the second arrow in Buddhism, right? Like, you have the first arrow of like, you lose a client, and then you shoot yourself with the second arrow because you're like, oh God, what did I do? I should have done this. I should have done that. You know, like, let's just turn towards reality, learn what we have to from it, and, you know, and then take that as it is.
Yeah, there's this wonderful Jack Welch coach, although I think the Gen Z is like a mix on Jack Welch, but I quite like his quotes. One of his quotes is, face reality as it is, not as it was or how you wish it to be. That is, you know, that is exactly what you said, and rooted in reality. Like, it sucks. It's true. It sucks right now, but like, there's no point in wishing about the past or wishing what it should be. It's just, what are you going to do right now in this moment about your reality?
And this is, I think, what I've learned about coaching is that coaching is training people and using conversations, training people to turn towards reality, especially as opposed to stories. the biggest thing that I see and identify in the coaching practice is like a situation boils up and it's deeply woven in, not just with the data that a camera could record, but the story of what it means. And I get sucked into this too as a coach, where it's like, oh, we build our response based on a story. And sometimes it's like, whoa, 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 let's take a step back. What's the data on the table? You know, it's not that she wants a raise, but she hasn't said anything, or she's angry at you, but she hasn't said anything. Like, let's look at the data of the behavior and the actions and the world as it is today. And then we'll set the story aside and we can revisit that later. And when we look at that, it's actually, that training is so powerful and so much easier to work around. But humans are storytelling machines. And the danger is our stories are not always wrong. Like, sometimes we're good at storytelling, but sometimes we're wildly off. But because we're good a certain percentage of the time, we continue to do it. But it's just all these layers and abstractions from reality. And one thing I've learned with psychedelic integration work is that psychedelics often teach you to take off the lenses that you don't even realize you're wearing. And all of a sudden you look at the world, you're like, oh, I didn't realize the world was this color. I thought everything was green. I thought everything was red. And so all of this coaching, psychedelics, every modality we use is just training on how to turn towards reality and be with it as it is.
Trust in leaders can be made or broken when things get tough. What's your advice for leaders who are dealing with what feels like a crisis right now? And it feels so impossible. And, you know, they are experiencing burnout and they just sort of like spinning their wheels, not sure what to do. What's your general advice for them?
I think about trust as something that oftentimes when we have a big fallout of trust and we turn around and let's say it's with our team, right? We do a layoff. Layoff is a great way to breach trust with the remaining team. And we turn towards them and we go, you know, this is never going to happen again. Or we make huge promises that are equal to the fallout of the trust. That's probably the worst way to reestablish trust. So what I find is that if there is trust either externally that you've had a fallout with or internally, right, you have broken trust with yourself, which is oftentimes on the path to burnout is true. The best way to address that is actually to start small and to make very small commitments and say, look, I know that we had a layoff and that was rough. And this came on the heels of us not sharing runway. So, you know, this week, at the end of every week, we're going to start to do runway check-ins with the team and start to be transparent. Okay. It's a little thing that you add. I mean, it's obviously a big decision, but a little thing. Then eventually you can start to say, okay, now as we start to meet our goals, we as a leadership team are going to be telling you how we're genuinely feeling about the goals, right? Okay, more vulnerability. And eventually you start to make medium-term commitments and then you follow through on those. You can start to make big commits and follow through on those. I think there was a book on it that may have been called The Speed of Trust that talks about this in an amazing way, but it's basically how you can heal that and do the repair work without the huge weighty expectations. It's like start small and make those commitments. Go medium, nail those commitments. Then people can start to trust you on the bigger ones. But there's a velocity as well to trust. So you make it, you share it clearly, and then you meet it. That builds a beautiful kind of virtuous cycle and upward spiral.
Right. And consistency and follow through is key here.
Yes, which is why you want to start small so that people, ideally on the daily,
yeah,
you can start to make small daily commits that you keep. That means way more than a massive commit that's going to take years that people don't get to see you follow through on.
I remember when every time it got hard, I'd open up, just open office hours for anyone in the company to, you know, just 15 minutes, 20 minutes just to talk through their concerns, ask me questions about, you know, the business.
Yeah, let them see you as a human.
Yeah. And I remember really taking every feedback to heart. And, you know, and now that I think about it, I was keeping that cadence of like, you know, you just told me this problem. I totally agree with you. I didn't see it before, but like, let's do something about it. And just showing that like us as a leadership team, we can change and we can adapt and we can listen. And I think it made us a stronger team. So thanks for sharing that. So let's think about Tracy Lawrence, let's say 10 years ago, maybe even more than that. So let's just like go back a little further. So let's just say 2010, just for the sake of time. 2010 you know, wherever you were in your life, what would you tell yourself at that point? If you go back in time and just tell her something about the startup journey, about being a leader that would help her along the way, what would you tell her?
Yeah, there's two things. One of them is that it takes a village to start a company. And to I would arm myself with those resources of a therapist, an advisor, a coach, you know, lean on my co-founder if you have a romantic partner. But like, assemble your resources because it takes a freaking village. And there's no shame to that. You know, now as I coach, I see that there's like this trifecta around the top performing CEOs that I work with, where they have a coach, they have a therapist, and they have a trainer. And that's the core of it. On top of maybe, you know, they have somebody cooking meals if they can afford it, or they have a great co-founder, or they have a, you know, a good partner. But like, that trifecta is magical. And I don't think CEOs talk about that. There's often this guise that like, oh, I know it all and I have to figure it all out. And I want to take that off the pedestal, which is like, no, we don't have all the answers. It's okay not to have all the answers, but build a support system so that you can have the resources to figure out what those answers are. That's the first thing. I think the second thing that I'm now understanding more as a coach working with CEOs is I would tell myself to pay attention to where I am energetically before I practice any speech, before I write any copy, before I go into any pitch. I used to spend a lot of time, like, let's talk about fundraising. I would build that deck to perfection. I would spend weeks on that deck. But I wasn't focusing on energetically, how do I want to show up for those meetings? Like, where do I want to be? And now that I support founders with this, you know, classic examples, all of founders come to me and be like, I'm about to have a difficult conversation. What do I say? And in the beginning, we used to like hammer out the script together and then they'd practice it and they'd practice it. And then what we started to realize was, screw the script. How are you feeling as you talk about it? What is the state that you want to be in when you talk about it? And then that question kind of softens the founder to go, oh God, I need to be in like a really open, honest state here, or I need to be in an empowered state, but I feel like a victim. Right. And so we actually focus on what's the state that you want to shift and what's the energy you want to be in. And then from there, the script fucking flows. What you need to say flows like perfection out of your mouth when your energy is aligned. And so I would pay much more attention to that, which is not like, this is much more intuitive way or even feminine way, I might argue, of doing business, where you focus more on the energy and the mindset. Men have access to this too, but we're just not trained to do it. We're trained to have a good script, to follow a protocol in the black and white. But I think there's a lot of gray and a lot of wisdom comes from being in the right mindset when you're fundraising. And then the pitch just flows. Everything flows so much easier.
Mm-hmm. And you don't have to be out for blood to be successful.
The moment that I could get in flow with like Foundry Group, okay? We had like, we were 32 pitches in of our Series A. Everyone had said no. And we sit down for lunch in Boulder and Brad Feld just looks at me and he's like, so tell me what you want to build. And I was pretty much convinced we were going to get another no and we were going to shut down. So I was like, fuck it. Like, so the attitude, I wasn't thinking about it then, but my mindset was, you know what? I don't actually care as much about what other people think of me as I do about the truth of the situation and what I want to build, whether it happens or not. That allowed me to disconnect from any kind of like weird, like, oh, I've got a pitch and make it good for, you know, the way that it looks to him. And I was just like, hey, I want to build a love company because like, here's how I see the world. And former me would have cringed like, no, don't tell investors that. They want you to be strong and whatever. And when I told him that, it was like by the end of that conversation, they were ready to invest. And I was like, oh, right. Because my energy was aligned. I hadn't prepped that pitch, you know, that script at all.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for sharing that. I love that. Tell us about one person who's helped you become who you are today. Is there that one person that you can share?
My co-founder. Mm. Yeah, I think. So I met him when I was 20 or 21. And he was one of the people that, first off, he was like, this can be a venture-backed business. And I was like, really? He's like, yeah, you can raise money for it. Like, he infused me with this belief to go bigger and to believe in myself. But even more importantly, he was the first person to tell me that it was okay to cry and like to have emotions about work. And I remember sitting in our office and we were within like, I don't know, 8 weeks of running out of money before prepping for a fundraise. And he looked over at me and he saw my face was dropped and he's like, you want to go for a walk? And I was like, yeah. And we're walking around Soma and I just sit down on a stoop somewhere and I just start sobbing. And he puts his hand around me and he goes, it's okay to cry. Yeah. And I was like, what? No, like I'm CEO. I'm not supposed to cry. I'm supposed to be strong. And he's like, no, like you're afraid to stop working with these people. You know, of course it's sad. You care about them. And I was like, I do. And he's like, maybe you should share it with the team. And I was like, that's horrifying. I would never share this with the team. They would all leave. And then because of his prompting and by an act of God, later that day or that week when I gave an all hands, I told the team exactly that. And because of that one talk, there was like barely a dry eye in the room. Everyone came up afterwards and hugged me. And nobody left during that period when we were really coming down to the wire and they knew it too. And so he fundamentally set me up to have an authentic, vulnerable leadership style. And I say that he spiritually reparented me. Like, I think he is absolutely the bee's knees and he's amazing. And yeah, he's dear to me even to this day.
Oh, that is really, really special. I had a lot of co-founders at my last company. I've started this company with my partner second time.
Wow.
And as you were talking, I was like, you know, these guys, they believed in me before I even believed in myself. And every time it got hard, they had no doubt that I could do whatever it was. Or they just couldn't do it. Like, you've done this before. Don't worry about it. Why are you so stressed out? You know, why are you scared? Just go do it, Tracy.
Wow.
And it was helpful. Like, I just needed to hear that. I just needed to see it in their eyes that they truly like didn't care. They weren't scared. They weren't worried in the same way I was. And just like seeing their confidence in their eyes just somehow like rubbed it off on me and made me confident in all those moments.
It's like so powerful to see that mirror, right, of somebody's confidence that helps you rise to that occasion. That's so profound. I fully feel you on that.
Mm-hmm. Any last piece of advice you would just want to share with our listeners? You know, they're all ambitious. They're all, many of them are women, some of them are men, and they're trying to make it work with light and with work, and they're all ambitious professionals. What's the advice you have for them?
You know, we touched on storytelling and some of the downsides of storytelling. But if we're to accept, let's turn to the reality of the situation, that humans are storytelling machines. You know, we at least like to tell stories. It gives us comfort in a world that is gray area. It gives us black and white. I think there is another skill set here, which is, how do you tell stories that serve you, that are in your favor? And I remember in particular when I was fundraising and, you know, I'd mentored and also just kind of pitched alongside women that were really scared about being women and fundraising. And in the beginning of my Series A, I like started to dress like one of my male mentors. And I'd wear Converse and like t-shirts and jeans. And like, that wasn't what I normally wore. If that's what you wear, great. But like, I was trying to be androgynous. And it's like, yeah, like that wasn't going to happen. Like, people knew I was a woman. What I started to get to was like, you know, I started to tell myself the story that actually everybody wanted to see a woman in their portfolio. That actually there were people that wanted women to be successful and to represent. And as I started to tell myself that story, I started to find more pieces of data and evidence that would support that story. And it was actually so incredible for my fundraise, because fundraising is hard enough when we tell ourselves these stories of all the ways that like people don't want us to succeed. So as I started to shift it and shift the narrative, it started to just, the world began to mirror my story. And I think there is some truth to that. You could call it manifestation. You know, you could call it sort of like quantum entanglement, but I found that that worked in my favor. And again, of course, we don't want to have those stories way overlook reality. Like, if you get a sexist comment or someone is overstepping their boundaries with you, you obviously have to always have your tight boundary, you know, behind that story. But maybe try telling yourself a story that's going to be awesome if the universe aligned with it. Founders were so paranoid. We're always thinking about the worst case scenario, right? Sometimes you can quiet that engine or stop feeding that wolf and try to feed a different wolf, the one that sees like the best version of your future. Even just give it a few minutes to be like, okay, I've thought about all the 10 ways that the startup could explode. What are the 2 ways that the startup would be amazing? What are the 2 ways that this initiative would put us on the map? Like, give it a little bit of thought. And the more thought you give it, the more it expands in your worldview.
I think that is incredible advice. Like, how do we open up our minds and have a wider perspective or even a completely different perspective? And how does that just affect whatever it is we're doing and trying to solve?
Right. And our reality too, mm-hmm. right? Because the moment you shift your perspective, your reality changes around you. And like, I don't know, I'm obsessed with truth and what truth is and what reality is. I haven't come to any complete answer on it, but I do find the more that I seed myself with different ways that I want the world to be, the more that the world sort of responds in kind. It's very odd.
Mm-hmm. Tracy, thank you so much for joining us today. I love your unique perspective. I've always loved your vibe and energy, and I know our listeners could feel it too. So thank you.
You're so welcome. Thank you for having me.